This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Imagine a world where what you see, hear, and maybe even feel online isn't just, you know, a reflection of your interests, but it's actually a carefully curated stream, one designed to kind of nudge your thoughts in a particular direction.
Right.
What if the very algorithm suggesting your next favorite song or the next product you buy are also subtly influencing national discourse, or maybe even predicting global events?
It's a pretty powerful thought, isn't it? That these digital architects, the ones making our lives more convenient, might actually be operating on a much grander, more impactful stage than we realize.
Exactly. Welcome, everyone, to the Security Nexus Deep Dive. We're brought to you by the Security Nexus. We're a Maryland-based national security consultancy, and we're really dedicated to informing, educating, and empowering you with knowledge that's clear, accessible, and hopefully actionable.
And today, we're diving into a topic that's, well, it's not just fascinating. It's becoming increasingly critical to understanding the world we live in.
Yeah, absolutely. Today, we're unpacking Operation Echo Chamber, how algorithms are becoming intelligence actors. So our mission for this deep dive is to really explore how these recommendation systems, the ones embedded in our social media, our shopping sites, everything, how they can morph.
Morph from tools of personalization.
Right. Designed for ease into something more potent. Tools that can, perhaps unintentionally, or maybe more alarmingly, intentionally shape public sentiment.
Or even fuel unrest, mask influence campaigns.
Exactly. We want to look at how these systems, which are fueled by just massive amounts of our personal data, are being used and studied in ways that, frankly, blur the lines.
Blurring the lines between everyday convenience and, well, critical intelligence gathering.
It's a fine line. You can find more of our insights and resources over at thesecuritynexus.net. Okay, let's really get into this. We're talking about these silent forces in our digital lives, and they seem far more impactful than many of us probably realize day to day.
Well, what's truly fascinating, I think, is how systems built for seemingly benign purposes, like, you know, helping you find a new pair of shoes or suggesting your next binge-worthy show, are evolving. They're becoming something far more sophisticated.
Yeah.
And the implications, they touch everything, don't they?
They really do.
From your individual privacy, your sense of autonomy, all the way up to national security, global stability. It's a huge spectrum.
It feels like a fundamental shift. It's moving from just simple recommendations to potentially shaping how entire populations view, say, a political event or even another country.
Precisely. It's a profound change in capability.
Okay, so to really get our heads around the gravity of this shift, we probably need to start at the beginning, right?
Yeah.
How do these intelligent recommendation systems actually work?
Yeah, foundation first. When we talk about them, we're essentially talking about these incredibly smart online tools, software programs that are constantly guiding us. Guiding us towards what they believe are the most suitable products or content or sometimes even people.
Like a personal digital concierge almost. Always anticipating what you might want next.
That's a good way to put it. Mm-hmm. And researchers Shanjin Zha, Zilu, and Yalan Yan, they really highlight this in their work on behavior trajectory security. They explain that these systems provide personalized recommendations based on what they call our behavior trajectories.
Okay, behavior trajectories. Sounds a bit technical. What does that mean in practice?
It does sound technical, but think of it simply as your entire digital footprint. It's like a meticulously detailed map of almost everything you do online. From, you know, the moment you pick up your phone in the morning until you finally put it down at night, every interaction.
And originally the motivation behind creating these systems was, well, it was supposed to be helpful, wasn't it? The internet is just this fire hose of information.
Oh, absolutely. We're practically drowning in content, right?
Yeah.
Zha, Lu, and Yan, and they're drawing on earlier research too, point out that a primary goal was always to combat information overload and also cognitive load.
Cognitive load. Like the mental effort it takes just to sift through everything.
Exactly. Imagine trying to pick one movie from a catalog of, say, 10 million titles without any guidance.
Yeah.
Or trying to read every single news article published globally today.
Impossible.
That's cognitive load. And other researchers like Abhaya Kumar Sahu and his co-authors, they elaborate on this. These systems aim to drastically reduce that struggle we face navigating vast amounts of information. The initial goal really was to make your digital life easier, more efficient, filter out the noise, present you with what supposedly matters to you.
So it started as this useful tool, almost like a benevolent digital assistant helping us manage the chaos. But these systems are just everywhere now, aren't they? It's way beyond just online shopping.
Oh, far, far beyond. Sahu and his team explained they're prevalent across virtually every mobile social media platform, every e-commerce site you can think of. They recommend everything from films and music to career alternatives, news articles, even potential romantic partners on dating apps. Oh. And others, like Anitha Ananthan and her colleagues, they further categorize this huge array of platforms where these recommender systems are deeply embedded. We're talking blogs, online forums, social networks like Facebook, Instagram, video portals like YouTube, TikTok. They're everywhere.
So they're inescapable, really.
Pretty much. And their presence significantly reduces the time and, you know, the mental cost for users searching for content. The idea is they improve our decision-making by intelligently filtering that digital flood.
So they've become like an indispensable part of our daily digital life, whether we fully realize it or not.
Right. And that brings us back to those behavior trajectories.
Yes. Let's unpack that a bit more. These systems are designed to make life easier, personalize our experience. But what exactly are these trajectories? What kind of data are we actually talking about? How detailed does it really get?
This is where the depth of their understanding really becomes quite apparent. Za, Lu, and Yan, they meticulously detail this. These trajectories include interactive behavioral traces within and across different applications.
Across applications. So not just what I do on Facebook, but maybe how I jump from Facebook to a new site.
Precisely. It's not just your browsing history on one website or your likes on a single platform. It's this intricate web of data points. Your exact search queries, the videos you watch, and crucially, how long you watch them for. Every article you click on, maybe even just skim. Every comment you leave, every like, every share.
That's already a lot.
But it goes deeper. It includes incredibly specific metadata, like how quickly you scroll past certain content, where your mouse cursor hovers on a page, how you jump between different apps on your phone.
Wow.
And often it includes geographical location information too. So it's tracing your physical movements alongside your digital one.
So every single digital interaction, no matter how small it seems, leaves this trace. It contributes to this constantly evolving picture of me.
Exactly. A picture of you, your habits, your preferences, maybe even your mood.
Okay, that sounds like a truly massive, incredibly intimate amount of personal information. I can almost hear the privacy alarms ringing for a lot of people listening.
And they should be ringing.
It's not just a profile. It feels almost like a digital twin that understands our habits, maybe better than we understand them ourselves sometimes.
You're absolutely right to feel that concern. Za, Lu, and Yan really emphasize this point. These behavior trajectories are deeply fundamentally linked to user security and privacy. They cite earlier work stating very clearly that when these digital traces are recorded against a person's wishes, privacy is unequivocally breached, full stop.
Right.
The sheer volume of this data, the granular detail, the deeply personal nature of it. It means its collection isn't just about optimizing your shopping cart for convenience anymore.
It's way beyond that.
It's about creating an incredibly comprehensive, predictive digital profile. A profile of your interests, sure, but also potentially your vulnerabilities, your psychological tendencies, maybe even predicting your likely future actions.
And that level of understanding that grants these systems immense power, doesn't it?
Immense power. That's the core issue.
Okay, so we have these incredibly sophisticated systems fueled by this vast, intimate ocean of our personal data, all supposedly in the name of convenience. But what does this really mean for us? The users? Are people actually satisfied with how their data is being handled? What are the unspoken trade-offs here?
That's a really critical question. And Za, Lu, and Yan actually did a study using grounded theory to try and pinpoint the factors that influence user satisfaction, specifically with the security protection around these behavior trajectories. They found several key things, much like you'd evaluate any service, really.
Okay, like what?
Well, first, there's the quality of security protection information itself. Is it timely? Is it complete? Is it understandable? Can you even find it? Is it accurate?
So it's not just that my data is protected, but how clearly and transparently that protection is communicated and how easy it is for me to understand and maybe manage it.
Exactly. Transparency and understandability are key. Beyond the information, there's the quality of the security protection system itself. Is it reliable? Is it easy to use? Can you actually navigate the privacy settings without needing a PhD in computer science?
Yeah, that's often a challenge.
And then, critically, there's the quality of the security protection service. This covers things like empathy, does the company seem to care?
Uh-huh.
Compliance with regulations, and, really importantly, user controllability. do you feel like you have meaningful agency over your data?
Those all make a lot of sense. What about more psychological factors, our own biases or how we behave online?
Yes, absolutely. Beyond those sort of technical and service qualities, they identify things like the perceived net benefits. Do the advantages outweigh the risks in the user's mind? And external support, maybe endorsements or reassurances. But perhaps the most revealing factors are the internal ones, our own level of privacy concerns, and what the researchers term privacy cognitive biases.
Privacy cognitive biases, like a mental shortcuts we take about privacy.
Sort of. And what's particularly insightful from their study is how privacy literacy directly impacts these concerns and biases. If you truly understand the implications of privacy, how data collection works, what the potential risks are, your concerns and biases naturally shift. You become more aware, hopefully more discerning.
That makes perfect sense. The more you know, the more you might worry, or at least be more conscious of the stakes involved. But then there's this idea of herd behavior. How does that fit into our approach to privacy?
Yes, herd behavior.
Yeah.
It directly impacts privacy concerns, often in a negative way. Za, Lu, and Yan highlight how individuals might just imitate others. They might discount their own information or privacy concerns simply because it seems like everyone else is sharing everything, right?
Yeah, that everyone else is doing it mentality.
Exactly. One interviewee in their study put it quite starkly. They said something like, seeing everybody's information is out there and it seems nobody cares about it, this could lead someone to adopt a more carefree attitude towards their own privacy.
Wow. So this collective indifference driven by seeing what others do, it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It makes us all potentially more vulnerable.
It can, absolutely. It's like being at a concert. If everyone else stands up, you feel almost compelled to stand too, even if you were comfortable sitting. It normalizes behavior that might otherwise give us pause.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me, and frankly, a bit unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
These systems were built to help us, right? To cut through information overload, make life easier. But they do it by collecting so much about us. And that data, combined with these very human tendencies like herd behavior and our cognitive biases, it just becomes incredibly powerful.
It's a profound dilemma.
The very convenience they offer could be used against us, or at least used in ways we might not fully understand or consent to.
Indeed. That tension between personalization and privacy is really at the absolute core of this entire discussion. What Za, Lu, and Yan ultimately conclude is quite profound. Intelligent recommendation is a double-edged sword. That sums it up perfectly.
A double-edged sword.
On one side, yes, it effectively reduces information overload. That's a clear, tangible benefit in our hyper-connected world. We feel it every day. But on the other side, it simultaneously introduces new, complex issues, profound privacy concerns, and ultimately user dissatisfaction when those concerns aren't properly addressed.
Yeah.
So what we're really witnessing is that this highly granular understanding algorithms gain of us initially conceived for commercial benefit, for user experience optimization, well, it can be repurposed. Repurposed, perhaps, in ways that extend far, far beyond just helping you choose your next purchase or movie.
Okay, so we've established how these algorithms collect mountains of incredibly detailed data about us. They build these comprehensive digital profiles, ostensibly to personalize our experiences. But how do these systems actually understand what we're feeling or thinking based on that data? How do they decipher the emotional tone, the undercurrents in our digital interactions?
Right, that's the next crucial layer. That capability leads us directly to a key technological pillar,
yeah.
Sentiment analysis.
Sentiment analysis. Okay, break that down for us. What is it fundamentally?
Fundamentally, sentiment analysis, or SA, is the process of computationally determining the emotional tone or the subjective opinion expressed within a piece of text. Is the text positive, negative, neutral? It's essentially about trying to quantify human emotion as it appears in digital form.
So, like a computer reading your email or tweet and figuring out if you're happy, angry, or just stating a fact.
That's the basic idea, yes.
Yeah.
It tries to capture that subjective polarity.
I remember when it first started getting attention, it seemed fairly basic, like just looking for positive or negative keywords in maybe product reviews online. Has it evolved much since then?
Oh, significantly. You're right. That was its initial foray, simple binary classification. As researchers like Temedeo, Michael Oladell, and Enya Faisaiterin explain, sentiment classification traditionally focused on those two buckets, positive or negative. But it's evolved quite dramatically over the years. Now, it routinely includes a neutral class, acknowledging that a lot of text isn't emotionally charged either way.
Right. Sometimes a comment is just a comment.
Exactly. And it's even moved towards multi-class categories for more nuanced emotions, trying to detect things like anger, joy, sadness, fear, surprise. This evolution really reflects the increasing complexity of human language and emotion that these systems are now attempting to grapple with and interpret.
And this isn't just about simple keyword spotting anymore, is it? This must rely on some serious machine learning to make these kinds of distinctions accurately.
Absolutely. Simple keyword lists are far too brittle. Modern SA relies heavily on various sophisticated machine learning methods for categorization. Oladell and Itiran list several common ones, things like maximum entropy, stochastic gradient descent, random forest classifiers, naive Bayes, but they particularly note support vector machines, or SVMs, which have often shown really good accuracy and efficiency compared to many other methods in numerous studies.
SVMs, how do they work? In simple terms, why are they good at this?
Well, imagine you have a bunch of data points, like tweets, some positive, some negative, scattered on a graph. An SVM tries to find the clearest possible line or boundary, technically a hyperplane, to separate the positive ones from the negative ones. It's really good at finding the optimal dividing line, maximizing the margin between the categories. This makes it quite robust, especially when the data isn't perfectly clean or easily separable. It learns from vast data sets of human-labeled examples to make these classification decisions.
Okay, so these algorithms use sophisticated machine learning like SVMs to understand emotion, but social media texts, as we all know, can be incredibly, well, messy, right?
Oh, understatement of the year.
It's full of abbreviations, slang, emojis, typos, URLs, hashtags, just general noise. How on earth do they deal with that raw, chaotic data before they can even analyze it?
That's a huge challenge, and it's where a massive amount of the engineering effort actually goes.
Mm.
Raw social media data is incredibly noisy, as you say. It requires extensive cleaning pre-processing before any meaningful analysis can even begin. Oladell and Iyetarin detail several essential pre-processing steps. First, you have to remove null data, get rid of empty tweets or irrelevant entries. Then they often use powerful libraries like the Natural Language Toolkit or NLTK in Python to remove common stop words.
Stop words like the A is, words that don't carry much emotional meaning.
Exactly. They don't usually contribute to the sentiment, so they're filtered out. Then all text is typically converted to lowercase for consistency. Words often undergo stemming.
Stemming? What's that?
Stemming basically chops off suffixes to try and reduce words to a common root form. So running, runs, and ran might all get reduced to something like run. It helps group related words.
Okay.
And finally, punctuation is usually removed as well. It's all about simplifying the text to its core components.
And other researchers like Amit Arora, Anshu Arora, and John McIntyre, they add even more layers to this cleanup process, don't they? To make it even more precise.
Yes, they do. They emphasize the importance of things like speech tagging, which means assigning parts of speech like verb, noun, adjective to each word. Understanding the grammar helps understand the context, which is crucial for sentiment. They also conduct more comprehensive noise removal, getting rid of URLs, at mentions, retweets, markers, various symbols that just clutter the text.
Makes sense.
They often go a step further than basic stemming by using lemmatization.
Lemmatization, how is that different from stemming?
Lemmatization is smarter. While stemming might just chop off endings, lemmatization uses dictionaries and morphological analysis to reduce words to their actual base or dictionary form, their lemma. So running, runs, and ran would all correctly become run. And importantly, better and best would both be reduced to good, not just truncated versions.
I see. That sounds much more linguistically accurate.
It is. This linguistic consistency is really crucial for accurate emotional analysis, especially with the nuances of language.
So it's this massive, multi-stage cleanup operation just to prepare the text. But once the text is clean, how do these systems actually process it to extract the sentiment? We hear so much about deep learning these days. Does that play a role?
A huge role. Deep learning, or DL models, are absolutely critical for effective sentiment analysis in today's world because they can learn incredibly complex patterns in data automatically. Researchers like Kapaya Kumar Sadhu's team and CN Dao and colleagues, they highlight the use of specific deep learning architectures. Models like long short-term memory or LSTM and convolutional neural networks or CNNs are very common.
Okay, CNNs and LSTMs, what do they do differently?
Think of CNNs as being really good pattern spotters. They're great at recognizing recurring features in the text, maybe specific sequences of words, the presence of certain emojis, or even the overall emotional shape of a sentence. They learn important local features. LSTMs, on the other hand, are a type of recurrent neural network with a kind of memory. They're excellent at understanding sequences and context. They can remember information from earlier in the sentence to understand the nuance of a word later on, which is vital for human language where word order matters so much.
Right. Context is everything.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And for even more advanced capabilities, you see researchers like Hanking Sun and his team proposing things like BERT BMA methods for analyzing public opinion on social networks. BERT, that stands for Bidirectional Encoder Representations from Transformers. It's a groundbreaking model. It's known for creating incredibly rich word embeddings or vectors. It understands words not just in isolation, but in deep relation to all the other words in a sentence, looking both forwards and backwards.
So it gets the full context.
Much more effectively, yes. And combining it with something like BILLSTM, a bidirectional LSTM, further enhances this by processing sequences in both directions, really capturing the full semantic flow and long-range dependencies in the text.
So these advanced models, they're not just looking at individual words anymore. They're analyzing the entire context, the nuances, the flow of a conversation, much more like a human would try to do.
That's the goal. And they're getting remarkably good at it. And often, the most powerful approaches actually combine these techniques. Dow and his team, for instance, showed significantly improved sentiment classification accuracy, often getting over 80% accuracy in F-score by combining pre-trained BERT models with both CNN and LSTM layers. This kind of hybrid approach leverages the distinct strengths of different deep learning architectures to achieve much more robust and accurate results in deciphering complex human emotions from raw, messy text.
Okay, so we've gone from basic positive-negative analysis to these incredibly complex deep learning models that can clean up messy tweets and understand the intricate context of human language. That's impressive tech. But what's the real-world impact of all this? It surely can't just be about figuring out if people liked a new movie, can it? That seems almost trivial given the sophistication of the technology involved.
You're absolutely right. This is where sentiment analysis moves beyond the trivial and becomes a core strategic capability with far-reaching implications. While it certainly started with product and movie reviews, as various researchers note, its application has just exploded, especially with the sheer volume of real-time public discourse available on social media.
Okay, so tell us more about those expanded, more impactful applications. What are some concrete examples we're seeing now?
Well, one really fascinating and potentially life-saving area is automated disaster monitoring. Alam and his team developed a novel methodology using social media sentiment as a key input feature for a CNN-based deep learning system. Their goal was to monitor disasters in real time. Imagine this. Their system automatically retrieved live Twitter feeds, processing a massive data set, 67,528 tweets in 39 different languages related to various disasters.
Wow, 39 languages. That's impressive coverage.
It is. And they achieved a remarkable precision level, 0.93, in pinpointing the actual locations of these disasters based purely on the social media chatter.
Just from tweets, how?
They found significant correlations. For instance, increased levels of negativity in the tweets correlated strongly with factors like the use of English, often used in international warnings, specific mentions like code red, and also higher numbers of retweets. All these were indicators of escalating alarm and the severity of the crisis in a particular location.
That's genuinely incredible. Using real-time social media buzz to identify and track disasters with that accuracy across language barriers. It sounds almost futuristic, like predicting where help is needed most before official reports even come in.
It is futuristic, but it's a very real-world application happening now with tangible benefits for emergency response.
Okay, what else? Beyond disasters.
Another significant area is public security threat management. Mud Suheri, MD Suhamin, and his colleagues conducted a survey showing a rapidly increasing interest among security agencies in using social media SA. They're using it for monitoring a wide array of public security threats. This includes criminal threats, think terrorism chatter, early signs of riots or protests, but also non-criminal threats like tracking natural disasters or disease outbreaks, like we saw with COVID-19.
So it's about monitoring, but also management.
Yes, it's not just about passive monitoring. It's about actively managing these threats and even detecting emerging events using geographic location tagging combined with sentiment analysis. It effectively provides a kind of digital early warning system for potential instability or crisis.
And I imagine this extends into areas like cybersecurity and even geopolitical intelligence gathering, too.
Yes, absolutely. Take the work by Aurora, and McIntyre. They developed specialized chatbots designed specifically to assess cybersecurity threats by analyzing sentiment on Twitter data. Their chatbot could actively search for keywords related to specific geopolitical events or security concerns and analyze the sentiment of the resulting flood of tweets.
Can you give an example?
Sure. During the initial phase of the Russia-Ukraine war, back in March 2022, they used their chatbot to search for terms like Putin, nuclear weapon, Russia, things like that, to extract relevant tweets. They observed, unsurprisingly, a significant spike in war-related tweets during that period. But interestingly, they found that neutral tweets actually outnumbered the clearly positive or negative ones.
Huh. What does that tell you?
Well, it demonstrates a real-time intelligence-gathering capability. It provides immediate insights into the nuances of global sentiment surrounding critical geopolitical events without needing human analysts to manually sift through millions of posts. It gives a snapshot of the public mood, the uncertainty, the discussion points.
So, pulling this all together, what does it mean for us? It means these algorithms are not just selling us stuff or helping us find our next favorite show anymore. They're becoming powerful interpreters of the global mood, potential threats, acting almost like a real-time global digital barometer.
They're definitely not just passive tools.
Not anymore.
And this really raises a fundamentally important question, doesn't it? If these sophisticated systems can accurately detect public sentiment around a disaster or a major political movement or a geopolitical crisis with such precision and speed, then the line between simple information processing and genuine intelligence gathering becomes extremely thin.
Yeah.
Very blurry. It implies this capability to understand the emotional pulse of entire populations at scale, to identify emerging trends, maybe even predict potential flashpoints. And that has profound implications far beyond just commercial applications.
So these algorithms are, in effect, becoming intelligence actors themselves, whether designed that way or not.
That's certainly the argument. They are gathering, processing, and interpreting information on a scale and with a speed that rivals and in some ways surpasses traditional intelligence methods. They are actors in the information space.
Okay, we've seen how algorithms can interpret this digital pulse, becoming incredibly sophisticated sentiment detectors, almost like global barometers. Now, let's push this concept even further. What happens when these capabilities aren't just about understanding that pulse, but about potentially shaping it? When algorithms move from being passive interpreters to active intelligence actors, maybe intentionally, maybe unintentionally, influencing outcomes?
This transition from observation to influence is a core and rapidly escalating concern for national security communities around the world. There was a really revealing study involving, I think, 36 Jordanian experts on national security. And it laid bare this stark consensus among them. Social media is frequently and systematically being misused to spread various security concerns, actively threatening national stability.
So this isn't just academic theory. This is based on the observations of experts dealing with these threats on the ground.
Exactly. It's grounded in their direct experience. And they detailed several critical types of misuse, painting a pretty sobering picture of the landscape.
What kind of misuse are they specifically seeing? What are the main categories?
Well, one major category they highlighted is the disruption of social security. This includes activities like cyber blackmail, where individuals are coerced online, or widespread cyberbullying, which can have devastating psychological and social effects. But it also extends to using these platforms to organize large-scale, often unsanctioned, gatherings or protests. Spreading malicious rumors designed specifically to sow distrust among the population or towards institutions, and even deliberately provoking internal strife within the nation, aiming to fracture social cohesion.
So the very platforms designed for connection and expression can be weaponized to sow discord and instability from within, exploiting existing societal fault lines.
Precisely. It's leveraging the platform's reach and speed for destabilizing purposes. Disinformation campaigns are another paramount issue identified by these experts. The study highlights social media as the main tool for spreading false information with deceptive intent. This isn't just, you know, accidental misinformation people share. It's deliberate strategy.
Designed to mislead.
Exactly. Designed to mislead. Capable of effectively weakening targeted countries by eroding public trust in government, in media, in each other, influencing elections, or even inciting real-world violence. Mood Suheri Amjad Suhaiman and his team, in their research, also list disinformation as a key public security threat, which really underscores how widely recognized this danger is now. It's a powerful, relatively low-cost weapon in the modern geopolitical toolkit.
And I'm guessing this ties into broader concepts of warfare, too, not just internal destabilization efforts.
Oh, absolutely. Deeply so. Social media is now seen as integral to what military and security strategists call hybrid warfare.
Hybrid warfare. That's the mix of conventional and unconventional tactics.
Right. It seamlessly blends traditional military posturing or action with cyber tactics and, critically, with information warfare. social media is a primary battleground for that information war. This often involves things like foreign electoral interventions trying to sway election outcomes in other countries and pervasive misinformation campaigns designed purely to create confusion, polarization, and division.
That sounds insidious.
It can be. A particularly chilling application highlighted by the Jordanian experts is inducing anxiety through manipulative narratives to misguide young people to wage war against their nations.
Wow. Using algorithms to target youth with narratives designed to radicalize them against their own governments.
That's the potential.
Yeah.
It shows the profound psychological dimension of these campaigns, targeting specific, often impressionable, populations with tailored narratives designed to fundamentally alter their worldview and incite action. It's a battle for hearts and minds fought on digital platforms.
That's a truly terrifying thought. Algorithms not just reflecting opinions, but actively being used to try and turn citizens against their own countries. What about more traditional intelligence stuff, like espionage?
Yes, even old-fashioned espionage has found a new, incredibly efficient digital playground on social media. Adversaries can systematically use social networking sites to recruit spies. They might build sophisticated fake accounts, meticulously cultivate relationships online with targeted individuals, maybe people working in sensitive government jobs or key industries.
Target selection based on their online profiles.
Potentially, yes. And then they exploit perceived weaknesses, build trust, or offer incentives to gather secretive and confidential information. It's a modern, scalable twist on an ancient practice, using the very platforms designed for connection as tools for infiltration and intelligence gathering.
So, given all these severe and diverse misuses, what do the experts recommend? How should governments respond?
Unsurprisingly, the Jordanian experts strongly recommended that governments need to invest heavily. Invest in technology for sophisticated online surveillance and analysis of social media activity. They advocated for developing highly automated systems capable of collecting and analyzing vast amounts of the data to effectively identify and counter these multifaceted threats in near real time. It's an arms race, in a way.
Okay, the idea that social media can be misused for such serious national security threats, disinformation, espionage, hybrid warfare, that's truly sobering. But it must also mean that world leaders themselves are acutely aware of these platforms and are actively using them for their own political communication, right? This isn't just a one-way street for shadowy actors.
That's a key observation, and it marks a profound shift in political communication over the last decade or so. Pablo Barbara and Thomas Zaitsoff, in their research, found something quite striking. By 2014, over 76%, more than three-quarters of world leaders, already had an active presence on social media.
76% back in 2014. That's huge.
It is. And it wasn't just a fleeting trend. They also found strong evidence supporting the idea that specific pressures increase the likelihood of leaders adopting social media. Namely, increased political pressure stemming from social unrest within their country, and also higher levels of democratization.
So leaders facing public pressure or operating in more open societies feel a greater need to engage directly via these platforms.
It seems so. It suggests it's seen as a pragmatic, responsive tool for leaders who are grappling with dynamic public sentiment and recognize the need, or perhaps the strategic advantage, of communicating directly with citizens, bypassing traditional gatekeepers.
So leaders aren't just joining Twitter or Facebook because it's trendy or because their PR team tells them to. They're responding to real political dynamics and using it as a direct tool themselves. What exactly are they doing with it beyond just posting updates?
They're engaging in what's sometimes called Twitter diplomacy, or more broadly, social media statecraft. Leaders use these platforms strategically to promote their country's image internationally. To advertise their policy positions, directly think of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani using Twitter extensively during the nuclear negotiations to shape the narrative. And critically, as we mentioned, they communicate directly with their own citizens and global audiences, effectively bypassing traditional media filters and controlling their message much more tightly.
And influencing agendas, too.
Absolutely. They strategically use it to try and influence both offline and online political agendas. We saw examples like U.S. President Barack Obama very effectively creating trending hashtags to rally public support or focus national discourse on specific legislative issues. It's a powerful direct channel for agenda setting.
Okay, so these platforms are real-time public address systems, direct communication channels, and also incredibly dynamic political battlegrounds. That makes sense. But this leads to another question. Can algorithms actually predict something as incredibly complex, human, and often spontaneous as social unrest? That seems like a massive leap from just analyzing sentiment.
It does seem like a leap, but it's a rapidly developing and intensely researched field right now. Gabriel Grill's research provides a really good overview here. He highlights how social media is increasingly being viewed and leveraged quite explicitly as a form of surveillance infrastructure, specifically for the purpose of civil unrest prediction.
Predicting protests before they happen.
That's the goal. Algorithms are being designed and tested to try and forecast protests, riots, strikes, and other forms of collective action across the globe. He mentions examples from Indonesia, Brazil, Australia. It's a global effort.
And who's funding this kind of research? That seems important.
Very important. Grill points out that much of this cutting-edge research is funded by major security and defense agencies. We're talking the U.S. Air Force, the Army Research Lab, IRPA, the Intelligence Community's Advanced Research Projects Agency, the Department of Homeland Security.
Okay, so this isn't just academic curiosity. This signals a serious strategic interest from governments and security apparatuses in developing this predictive capability.
Undeniably. It signals a long-term investment and belief in the potential of these tools for strategic foresight and potentially intervention.
That's fascinating and maybe a little alarming too, predicting unrest using social media data. How do they even begin to do that with any degree of accuracy? What are the actual mechanisms or techniques involved?
Well, researchers employ a pretty sophisticated range of methods, as Grill details, trying to capture those subtle digital signals that might precede collective action. These include standard statistical techniques like logistic regression, but also simpler, yet sometimes effective, methods like tracking spikes in specific keywords or hashtags related to grievances or mobilization. And increasingly, they're using advanced machine learning, deep learning models, decision tree-based methods like random forests, and those support vector machines we talked about earlier.
And what kind of features are these models looking for in the data?
They're trying to capture a variety of features. Shifts in overall sentiment and effect in language. Are people getting angrier, more determined? Sudden spikes in communication volume around certain topics. Patterns of social media engagement, likes, shares, comments, escalating. They also look at the characteristics of information propagation. How quickly and widely is a particular message or call to action spreading? Are there explicit statements indicating an intent to protest? Are mobilization networks forming? And, of course, geographic location tags are crucial for pinpointing potential hotspots.
So the algorithms are essentially looking for these digital precursors, these patterns that historically have preceded organized public action, and building predictive models based on that.
That's the core idea, learning from past events to predict future ones based on the digital breadcrumbs left behind.
Can you give us a concrete example, maybe something from recent history where this kind of analysis was relevant?
Certainly. Oladel and Ayetrin, whose work on sentiment analysis we discussed, they mention how their model, trained on tweets related to social unrest, could effectively classify tweets as either favoring unrest or opposing it. They specifically cite the hashtag #EndSARS movement in Nigeria as a powerful example of a dynamic social movement where this kind of real-time sentiment and activity analysis could be applied.
Okay.
And going further, Hanking Sun and his co-authors proposed those advanced BERT-BMA models we touched on. Their goal was explicitly to enhance the detection of public opinion emergencies. They achieved this not just by looking at sentiment, but by meticulously mining the dependencies between users, figuring out who influences whom online, and analyzing the precise trajectories of how information, or perhaps calls to action, disseminate through the network.
So understanding the network structure and the flow of influence.
Exactly. And their experiments, run on large Twitter and Weibo datasets, consistently show their method was superior in accurately detecting these kinds of emerging events. They can spot not just the sentiment, but how it's spreading and who seems to be driving it.
So it really feels like it's not just about what we see or feel online anymore, but it's about what these systems allow certain actors to do, for better or for worse, in the geopolitical and social arena. They're predicting the future of social movements, detecting emerging public crises. That's a truly profound shift in the capabilities of non-human intelligence, isn't it?
It really is. And if we connect this back to the bigger picture, this ability of algorithms to not only detect, but potentially predict and maybe even influence large-scale human behavior, It fundamentally changes the landscape of national security, international relations, even domestic policy.
Yeah.
This goes far beyond simple data analysis or opinion polling. It's about algorithmic influence operating at scale.
Hmm.
These systems are becoming potent, often silent, actors in global affairs, capable of a kind of foresight that could shape policy, preempt crises, or, in darker scenarios, be used for unprecedented levels of manipulation and control.
This has all been incredibly illuminating, and I imagine for many listening, maybe a bit unsettling too. We've tracked how algorithms are evolving from simple recommenders to active shapers of public sentiment, predictors of social unrest, even operating as intelligence assets with serious national security implications. This brings us squarely to a crucial, perhaps the most unavoidable aspect of this whole discussion, the ethical frontier. How do we possibly balance this incredible, accelerating technological progress with the absolute necessity for protection, for oversight, for responsible governance?
It's the central question, isn't it? And it circles back to this constant, recurring theme in the digital age, often called the dual-use dilemma.
Dual-use, meaning the same tech can be used for good or bad.
Exactly. On one hand, social media has been widely, and often rightly, hailed as a liberation technology. Barbara and Zaitsev mentioned this, citing earlier work by Larry Diamond. It empowers protesters, dissidents, ordinary citizens challenging the status quo. It provides a vital platform for organizing, sharing information, mobilizing support, and challenging incumbent powers in ways that were simply unimaginable just a generation ago.
We saw that clearly in things like the Arab Spring or countless civil rights and activist movements globally gaining traction through social media.
Absolutely. It has undeniably been a force for democratic expression and mobilization in many contexts.
There's always a but, isn't there? The flip side, as we've already hinted at, is that the very same powerful tools can be turned against those movements and against citizens by those who hold power.
Precisely. Barbara and Zaitsev also reference Evgeny Morozov's work from 2012, pointing out that social media is also an incredibly potent tool for incumbents, governments, security agencies, corporations to monitor activists and dissidents. And Gabriel Grill, whose work on unrest prediction we discussed, he explicitly frames these systems not just as analytical tools, but as surveillance infrastructure.
So the same technology that helps dissidents organize can also help authoritarian regimes track them down.
That's the stark reality. It's the same underlying technology, but its application, its impact, depends entirely on who is wielding it and for what purpose. It creates this profound inherent tension.
So it's definitely not a neutral technology then. It's inherently embedded in existing power dynamics, and the design choices made when building these systems probably reflect those dynamics.
Absolutely. Grill argues this very compellingly. He says, these civil unrest prediction technologies inherently embody power relations. The way they're designed, the way they're framed, they tend to target specific online activities, often focusing primarily on identifying risks to various powerful actors, risks to the military, to law enforcement, to certain industries.
And what about the perspectives of the protesters themselves, the people actually involved in the unrest?
That's the critical omission, Grill points out. He notes that the perspectives, the safety concerns, the legitimate grievances of the protesters themselves are, in much of this research and the resulting product design, almost completely absent.
Wow. So it creates a significant ethical imbalance in how these tools are developed and deployed. The focus is often on managing or containing dissent, rather than maybe understanding or addressing its root causes from the perspective of the people actually expressing it.
That's often the critique, yes. It highlights a bias towards control and stability, as defined by those in power, rather than necessarily towards justice or addressing the underlying issues driving the dissent in the first place.
Okay, given these really significant ethical concerns and these inherent power dynamics, it's imperative we ask, how reliable are these algorithmic intelligence systems, really? Are there fundamental limitations or critiques we should be aware of before we just assume they're infallible crystal balls?
Oh, absolutely. It's crucial to understand their limitations. Grill, among others, points out that the fundamental validity of using social media data as a perfectly representative proxy for predicting complex, real-world social phenomena has been consistently questioned by researchers.
Why? What are the issues with the data itself?
Well, several things. The data generated on platforms like Twitter or Facebook might not be truly representative of the broader offline population. Certain demographics, older people, poor communities, those in rural areas might be significantly underrepresented. Also, online discourse can easily become an echo chamber, right? What's trending online might not accurately reflect wider public opinion at all.
Yeah, we've all seen that happen.
And Grill specifically cites the well-known failures of systems like Google Flu Trends. Remember that?
Vaguely, yeah. It was supposed to predict flu outbreaks based on search queries.
Exactly. But it dramatically overpredicted flu outbreaks for several years because it relied too heavily on search query data that didn't always correlate reliably with actual confirmed flu cases. People search for flu symptoms for many reasons. It highlights the inherent volatility of such data, as Grill puts it, and the real danger of over-reliance on these digital signals without extremely careful validation and consideration of context.
So it's definitely not a perfect crystal ball. Relying too heavily on these systems without understanding their biases and limitations could lead to significant misjudgments, maybe even harmful policy decisions or resource misallocations.
That's precisely the risk. And beyond just the technical accuracy issues, there's this broader ethical dimension that needs attention, particularly within the academic and development communities that actually build these tools.
What kind of ethical reflection is needed there?
Grill emphasizes what he calls a critical need for regulation centering activists and workers. The people often most affected by surveillance, alongside deep reflection within academia, especially in fields like computer science and data science. This reflection, he argues, needs to focus squarely on the ethics and politics of protest research and ensuing technological applications. We need to ensure that the development of these incredibly powerful tools is guided not just by technical feasibility, but by responsible, equitable, and human-centered principles.
So it's a call for a fundamental reevaluation, looking beyond just can we build it, to should we build it, and who benefits, who is harmed.
Exactly. It's about embedding ethical considerations right from the start, thinking critically about the societal impact, rather than just chasing technical capability or fulfilling the requirements of powerful funders.
This discussion of limitations and the call for ethical oversight is absolutely crucial. But let's not forget the human element in all this. We're the ones generating all this data, and we bring our own messy human biases and behaviors to the digital sphere. How do our inherent human tendencies intersect with these powerful algorithms? Does it create a kind of feedback loop?
That's a vital connection to make, and it loops right back to what we discussed earlier regarding user satisfaction and privacy. Let's recall those findings from Zha, Liu, and Yan about herd behavior and privacy cognitive biases. These are deeply ingrained human tendencies, right?
Yeah, the tendency to follow the crowd.
Exactly. Herd behavior, for instance, where users might become indifferent to privacy concerns simply because they observe everyone else is using it anyway, or everyone else is sharing this kind of information, so why shouldn't I? Mm. It creates this kind of collective shrug, doesn't it? A lowering of the individual guard, driven more by social proof what others are doing, rather than by a fully informed, conscious decision about one's own data.
So if everyone else is sharing their vacation photos or their political opinions or taking that viral quiz, I might feel pressure, or just feel it's normal, to do the same. And these systems are probably very good at amplifying that feeling.
Precisely. These human tendencies can be significantly amplified, perhaps even exploited, deliberately or inadvertently, by recommendation systems. If algorithms are designed, as they often are, to show you what like-minded individuals are doing, what's trending within your social circle, what your friends are engaging with, they can powerfully reinforce this herd behavior,
making us potentially more susceptible.
It can make individuals even more susceptible to influence campaigns or the spread of disinformation, precisely because it arrives cloaked in social proof. It feels like everyone else is thinking this or doing this, making it harder to question. Aurora and McIntyre highlighted this perfectly when they noted that written text on social media sites is impacted by the emotions, intentions, and thoughts of the user. And it's precisely this emotional and intentional content that algorithms can then identify, categorize, amplify, and feedback to specifically targeted, susceptible audiences. It's a powerful feedback loop.
And isn't it deeply ironic that the very problem algorithms initially aim to solve, that feeling of information overload, cognitive load, might actually be making us more vulnerable to this kind of manipulation in the end?
It is a profound and troubling irony, isn't it? The initial goal, as Zha, Liu, and Yan pointed out, was laudable. Reduce information overload, reduce cognitive load, make our digital lives easier to navigate. But in doing so, by simplifying vast amounts of complex information and presenting us with carefully curated, personalized, often emotionally charged narratives, these systems can ironically make users more vulnerable to simplified, potentially manipulative perspectives.
How so?
Well, when you're feeling overwhelmed or cognitively fatigued from that constant stream of information, you're naturally more likely to grasp onto a simplified version of reality, especially if it's presented persuasively by an algorithm, and particularly if it appears that everyone else in your online world seems to be agreeing with it.
It creates a shortcut to understanding, but maybe a dangerous one.
It can create a powerful, often subconscious pathway for influence, bypassing critical thinking precisely because it reduces cognitive load and leverages social conformity.
So pulling all these threads together, what does this all mean? We've seen how algorithms are these incredibly sophisticated tools that can interpret our deepest sentiments, predict collective actions from disaster response to social unrest. They function as intelligence gatherers. But the question that just echoes throughout this whole conversation is, in whose hands are these tools truly operating, and for what ultimate purpose? It feels like a very deep, very complex space that touches everything from our individual autonomy to our collective destiny.
That really is the crux of it. And it raises this fundamental question. As these algorithms become ever more powerful, effectively acting as autonomous or semi-autonomous intelligence agents, we absolutely must question not just their technical capabilities, but perhaps more importantly, the ethical frameworks, the governance structures, the accountability mechanisms that surround their development and deployment, or the lack thereof.
Yeah.
Their capacity to shape perception, to influence behavior, to predict and potentially preempt human action on a global scale. That is a truly formidable, maybe even unprecedented kind of power.
It feels like we're at a critical juncture, doesn't it? Where the architects of our digital experience, often unseen and unaccountable, hold this immense and often unchecked power over how we understand our world and how we interact within it.
We absolutely are. And the implications are profound. #outro.
Well, we've certainly taken a deep dive today. We've journeyed into the complex world of intelligent recommendation systems, uncovering how their personalized services, powered by our every digital footprint, are also becoming potent actors in realms like public security, political influence, and even national intelligence.
Yeah, from predicting social unrest with sometimes startling accuracy, as some researchers like Oladell and Ayetjerin showed, to being potentially exploited for disinformation and espionage, as those Jordanian experts detailed. These algorithms are fundamentally reshaping our understanding of influence and control in the 21st century.
Absolutely. And we've seen how various researchers like Xia Liu and Yan or Aurora and McIntyre really illustrate that inherent double-edged sword nature of this technology. It offers incredible convenience, yes, but simultaneously raises these profound privacy questions, ethical concerns, especially around human cognitive biases and how algorithms can amplify them.
It seems abundantly clear now that our digital interactions are no longer just personal communications or simple transactions. They are meticulously collected data points within this vast global system of analysis and increasingly influence.
Yeah.
The technologies are just advancing at an absolutely astonishing pace. And with that speed comes this profound responsibility for developers, for policymakers, for all of us as users to truly understand their implications. Implications for our societies, for our democracies, and maybe even for the very future of how we perceive truth and engage in public discourse.
So as we continue, seemingly inevitably, to delegate more of our information filled, maybe even parts of our decision making, to these powerful algorithms, we have to ask, what is the true long-term cost of all this convenience?
That's the question.
And critically, how do we as a society ensure that the architects of our digital experience, whether they intend to or not, are not becoming the silent shapers of our collective reality, nudging us, subtly but powerfully, towards futures we never explicitly chose or perhaps even debated?
These are monumental questions, and today's deep dive really only scratches the surface.
It really does. We strongly encourage you, everyone listening, to reflect on your own digital footprint, maybe question the algorithms that govern your feeds and recommendations, and just consider the broader implications for yourself and for society as a whole. For more insights into this ever-evolving landscape of cyber threats, hybrid warfare, strategic security policy, and the role technology plays, please do visit us at thissecuritynexus.net.
Thank you for joining us on the Security Nexus Deep Dive.
We hope this exploration has given you a fresh, maybe even a challenging perspective on some of the hidden forces at play in our increasingly interconnected, algorithmically mediated world.